Hello and welcome back to The Sound of Economics. I'm Nicholas Bauer and today
we're going to get Brexit done.
Today we will be discussing Britain's financial services industry and what may or may not happen to it after Brexit. And I'm joined today by Rebecca Christie. Hi Rebecca, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you today?
I am very good, thank you. So you have been reading and writing about the financial services industry in Britain and the Brexit process and what may or may not happen next. So just to start off, how important is the financial services industry to Britain, and how important is Britain's financial services industry to the rest of Europe?
Financial services is one of Britain's trademark industries. London is known as the city, capital letters, because of the big role that banks and investment firms and related companies have played in the city's development and in the city's growth. Likewise, for Europe, there's been a historical reluctance to take on some of these market activities that have been so successful in London. And so it suited everybody for people with money on the continent to do most of their business and transactions in London, and for people in London to have customers on the continent.
And of course, it had an advantage by being inside the European single market, but outside the Eurozone.
Well, you can argue both ways about whether being outside the Eurozone was a true advantage, but being inside the single market was a huge advantage. And certainly for people from the rest of the world, being able to set up shop in London, in a place where English was the working language, where working globally was routine and part of everyday business, and yet you were within the regulatory umbrella of the EU and able to trade seamlessly and frictionlessly with all the other countries, was a huge advantage for people.
Now, back in 2016, people were worried that the referendum result itself would trigger a kind of crisis.
Well, early results have upset the world's financial markets, with the pound falling again in the past hour to $1.34, its lowest point since 1985.
One of the first things to take a hit this morning, of course.
But one of the things you've noticed is that, or at least one of the things you've observed, is that we've been remarkably short of shocks in London. Why do you think that is?
It's been almost a success story that Brexit hasn't triggered a crisis or even a big market crash so far. Certainly, we've seen the pound has adjusted quite a bit in response to Brexit as Britain rethinks its role with the world. But in terms of a big shock like we saw from the U.S. subprime market or Lehman Brothers, we really haven't seen an earthquake of that magnitude on that sort of scale. Instead, what we've seen are a lot of people worrying and a lot of people making adjustments and a lot of time for markets to get into position for what's coming next.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think we haven't seen so many shocks? Does no one know?
Transition periods are the big thing. What the markets were afraid of in 2016 was that some deadline would come and go and there would be no deal and there would be no extension and everyone would have to adjust on the fly. We've seen now that that hasn't happened. Whenever the cliff edge deadlines have come up, there have been extensions.
European Union leaders and UK Prime Minister Theresa May have agreed to delay Britain's departure from the EU until October 31st.
The UK government gained an extra 92 days today.
From March to October to the end of the year. Now, as we head into January 31st, which looks like it might actually be a transition point, people have had a lot of time to get prepared, to think about what might be coming, and to make provisions for what could happen.
So for those unaware of the current Brexit process, Britain formally leaves the European Union at the end of this month on the 31st of January, but it stays in the European economic orbit until the end of this year, at which point we have a kind of another potential hard Brexit scenario coming up on December the 31st. So what's the difference between, what's the material difference between banking on Friday the 31st of January and, I guess, Monday the 3rd of February?
Okay, so that's the current timeline, and it sure looks certain, but until the withdrawal agreement gets through Parliament, January 31st is still another deadline, albeit one that looks more certain to happen than the previous ones. But it's important, I think, not to get ahead of the process. Likewise, the Johnson administration has said, Boris Johnson has said that as prime minister, he wants everything to be wrapped up by the end of 2020. That's a fine rhetorical goal. What that means in terms of how talks actually happen, you know, we'll have to see. It's more of a political marker as far as I'm concerned. Many analysts who are focused on some of the specifics, have rightly noted that there's a deadline in June for seeking an extension on certain provisions. Johnson has said he doesn't want any extensions. He wants everything wrapped up. I don't think we'll know until late May, mid-June, whether he seeks an extension on certain key things. I think if an extension is sought, it will be billed as something purely technical, purely transitional, purely legal. They'll find some way to spin it as not a big about face, but as a way of making technical adjustments so that you don't have any sort of, again, disruption. Same thing for December 31st. If we get into a situation where talks are going halfway decently, they'll make some kind of announcement and say, oh, we've agreed on what the end game will look like, and now we're just going to have technical talks from here out. And the technical talks can take as long as necessary.
Now, one of the things on the negotiating table over the next year will be passporting rights. Now, for those who don't know, among our listeners who maybe don't follow Brexit as avidly as some of us, what are passporting rights and why are they important?
So passporting is great because if you have a passport and you're within the European single market, you can pretty much just go out and do business.
But you don't mean a person, you mean a company, an organization.
I mean a company or a banking business or a financial entity. And in this sense, a business passport is a thing that you get that allows you to provide a certain set of services across the European Union with essentially one regulatory system. You don't have to go, it's like having a driver's license. You don't have to get a driver's license in each and every small town that you drive through. You have one and it's recognized. That will go away as soon as Britain leaves the single market. Will Britain leave the single market, you say? Well, we don't know, but it seems unlikely that they will stay in it past the end of however many transition periods are extended. It doesn't look like anything is in the works that will keep Britain politically close enough to the European Union for the European Union to allow Britain to stay in the single market. So, in answer to your question about what is passporting and why is it important, well, it's been really handy for letting financial market companies do business and keep their costs down. Once they lose the passport, they'll have to spend a bunch more money, probably hiring middlemen, whether that's setting up their own office somewhere, whether that's hiring lawyers, whether that's hiring pass-through people. That's going to be the main effect. The next thing on the table, if you can't get a passport, there's something called equivalence, regulatory equivalence. This isn't as good as a passport because it's not permanent. It doesn't apply to as many things. It's very specific. You have to apply for each specific equivalence thing under the different laws that set out the European laws that set out the possibility for it, and it can be withdrawn at any time. We see with Switzerland, for example, Switzerland had financial market equivalence that it lost as part of a broader snag in an effort to renew all of Switzerland's trade deals with Europe. So that was a bummer for a lot of the financial companies that like to do business in Switzerland and in the EU at the same time. The way that they got around that was they drew some lines in the sand. They pulled some of the business back to Switzerland and took it out of the EU. And now if you want to do that business, you have to go to Switzerland to do it and you have to pay somebody extra.
Okay, so I have two questions. Firstly, in terms of passporting as we know it, is there any way that can be done outside of the single market? Is that plausible? And my second question is, if it's not and we fall back into this atmosphere of equivalence, as you say, does that mean that the 27 other member states have a kind of constant, they can hold an axe constantly over the City of London and take away their rights at any time if they so choose to do so? And some of them may or may not have incentives to diminish London's power.
So passporting is only for people who are working within the single market. The single market can work for people who are outside of the EU, but usually doesn't. London will become what they call a third country. So no passporting once we get to this phase, assuming that's where we're
going. Not under any circumstances.
Unless they're staying in the single market, they don't get passporting.
Okay.
Equivalence is another thing. It's done at the EU level, not at the member state level. So at least you don't have 27 different governments plus regions and things like that coming and going and giving and taking on these things. There are European regulations, and the European Commission has a good page on this listing all of the different regimes for which equivalence is available. So you can get an equivalence decision, but they have expiration points. They have to be renewed periodically. There's no international standard for equivalence. There's no international committee that says, here's what we recognize as equivalence. So it's a little bit at the whim of EU, even if it is EU law, which is a structured process, but the EU has a lot of control over what it wants to say. It has the ability to withdraw it. And of course, it doesn't have any obligation right now to be transparent about the process. So you apply for it. Do you get it? Do you not get it? How long does it take? Don't know.
So could taking away this equivalent status for British firms be a negotiating tactic or a lever that the European Union could pull in trade negotiations over the next 11 months?
Absolutely. And pretty much going forward. Even though both sides have a real incentive to keep financial services flowing and keep financial services working efficiently across the channel, it's also a very important sector, and as a result, it's going to be a bargaining chip. Europe is not going to give Britain a fast track on financial services just because it likes doing business with London. If anything, they're going to say, look, you like doing business with us, and they're going to make sure that Britain cooperates on other levels to get the level of cooperation on banking and related services that they'd like to see.
Let's say London somehow loses this equivalent status, or it has some kind of like difficult hurdles to overcome to do what it was doing before. Can London's financial services industry survive losing its current relationship with Europe?
Yeah, I mean, on equivalence, it's not just one thing. Equivalence is, I think it's 17 different regulations, and within that, there are different subcategories. So equivalence is by nature a fragmented process. It's a nice thing if you have. If you don't have it, it makes certain things more complicated. But if you don't have it, the easiest way around it is to hire middlemen, to either hire lawyers or create a branch or a subsidiary. One example that comes to mind is the credit rating agency system. Credit ratings are essential to almost everything in the market. The European Central Bank also has a regulation saying, I don't know if regulation is the technical term, but anyway, they have a requirement that for credit ratings to be usable within the euro area, they have to come from a euro area rating firm. Most of the credit ratings firms are in London. So what do? They set up licenses, they set up companies, they set up things within the euro area that can then endorse the ratings that come out of London. So the ratings are still coming out of London, or they will be if necessary, but they'll get an endorsement from an ECB-approved euro area entity, and that's how they'll be able to keep the system going.
So if all the biggest London firms can open subsidiaries in Europe, does any of this matter at all? Do they have to be in the single market?
It does matter. It matters more for some functions than others. For example, the central counterparties and clearinghouses for various types of trades and for derivatives trades, those are more complicated. Those require a little more thought technically on how to move things around. For some of this other stuff, yeah, it's a drag. It's inconvenient. You might have to look a little harder to find workers because in London you have everybody in one place. And if you have to get somebody to commute to Frankfurt or to Dublin, you may have to pay a little more or deal with a different pool of talent. But most of this stuff can be worked out. And the private sector has had several years to get ready now.
Is it possible the City of London will move closer to Wall Street?
Closer to New York, that's an interesting question because we've seen already that some business is just retrenching to New York. People who had set up shop in London because it was an easy place to work, because it was inside the single market, now that things are fragmenting anyway, are thinking, well, I can do some of this from New York or from my hub. We're seeing business move out of London to a cluster of European cities. So there isn't any one European city that's taking over. Instead, people are moving to Dublin, Paris, Frankfurt, Amsterdam, Luxembourg. Things are shaking out a little bit by function, a little bit by jurisdiction. For example, in Ireland, a lot of UK lawyers can register to get Irish law licenses fairly easily, and they're working out how that's going to work. There's a think tank called New Financial. A guy, William Wright, runs that. They've done a lot of very detailed research on who's moving where and exactly the scale of the assets. There have been some other reports that Central Bank of Ireland has done some work on this. So people interested in that, I would encourage you to go and read those papers in fuller detail than we're going to get into in this broad overview study of where things are headed.
Now, if you talk to a Brexiteer about these kind of things, or a proponent of Brexit, about the City of London after Britain leaves the European Union, they might mention something called Singapore on Thames. Now, for those unfamiliar with Southeast Asian economics, can you define Singapore on Thames first? What do they mean when they say that?
So what they mean when they say that is sort of a utopian, low regulation, free trade zone where everyone will want to come and have a bank that will be lightly regulated and yet functional, and it will be this magical global financial center. The reality is not so clear. Singapore, for one thing, is a controlled economy. It's a small space. It's not some sort of, you know, science fiction-esque free-for-all zone. It's a very well-maintained, self-contained space.
So what are the benefits of investing in or being in Singapore if you're a bank?
In actual Singapore?
Yes.
It's a great hub for Asia. Within Asia, it's a place where people are familiar with the legal regimes and the way of trading. It's got a lot of common standards for how people can come together. It's a trading center.
Okay. So can London be that?
London can be a trading center. It may even end up looking like actual Singapore. But when people talk about Singapore on Thames, they don't mean actual Singapore. They mean this fantasy they have of this light touch, low regulation, free trade utopia. And that is unlikely to happen. London is going to have to continue to comply with a lot of the global banking standards. London is going to have to continue to keep its standards high, first of all, for its own sake. After the crisis, there are a lot of regulations put in place to avoid excessive risk-taking that make a lot of sense independent of the EU system. And going forward, London is just not going to be able to strip down all the regulations and have a financial system that people are going to have confidence in.
I mean, historically, regulations haven't always survived just because they make common sense. If they did, we might not have been in this situation in the first place. So does that really stop the government from just deregulating and undercutting the European financial services industry from London?
I have two thoughts on that. The first is that the UK has pretty recent experience with so-called light touch regulation, and that didn't go so well. A bunch of big banks failed. They had to be nationalized. There were some big bailouts. That wasn't a great experience, and that was fairly recently. And a lot of those policymakers are still around at the Bank of England and in the Treasury, the UK Treasury. The other thing is that the sorts of free trade agreements that the UK is going to want are going to demand some level of risk management. Risk management is important now. You can't just sort of say, well, we haven't had a default in a long time. Things will probably be fine. Leading up to the U.S. subprime mortgage crisis, that's how a lot of people were doing business, and that won't fly in today's environment.
Presumably part of the idea of having a Singapore on Thames is low taxes, is that right?
Probably. It's not something I've spent a lot of time studying.
Okay. Well, I assumed that was kind of implied in it, and I don't know. I'm assuming Singapore doesn't have such a huge and expensive welfare state as Britain, which of course needs to be funded somehow, and part of that has been by taxing the financial services industry. So it's unclear to me whether Britain can afford to have a kind of to undercut Europe on taxes, and whether that's electorally feasible, as there seems to be quite a lot of austerity fatigue in Britain at the moment.
Yeah, well, taxes are interesting because the EU doesn't regulate taxes. Taxes are very much subject to what each member state wants to do. To have any sort of European approach on taxes, it has to be agreed absolutely unanimously. So that means you see some agreements on things like value-added taxes or very specific sorts of disclosure things in the wake of some of the recent corporate tax scandals. But you don't see anything on rates. You don't see anything on corporate taxes that succeeded. All of the European proposals on creating a common corporate tax base, for example, or a financial transaction tax, those are all very much stuck. So no, I don't see Britain putting in a financial transaction tax, but I also don't see anybody in Europe doing it other than on perhaps a very token level, as we've seen people try to do in France and Germany.
Do you think people overestimate taxes as a factor in these things?
Looking specifically at financial markets, it's not a subject that came up very much. Backing out a little bit to the general conversation, I think it's something that Britain is looking at. Corporate taxation generally is something that people see as a bargaining chip. You know, where are the profits? Are the profits being onshore, offshore? Britain already has the Channel Islands and places like that that are seen as a place to set up a letterbox company to avoid paying taxes. So yeah, Britain that's outside the EU might try to mess around with the taxes that it collects in a way to try and bring in more rich people or more corporations. But I don't think that's going to be a driver in terms of the UK-EU relationship. What I do think is important is what the EU will do with its own financial system when it doesn't have the UK sitting in all the meetings making suggestions. The UK has a lot of expertise on financial services issues. It's got a lot of clout, a lot of respect. With those voices not being there in the meetings, the EU is going to be talking to itself, and they're going to have to say, how much do we want to have capital markets? We talk about capital markets union, but how far are we willing to go? What do we want to do? To what extent do we want to really centralize everything and really push through a one-size-fits-all rule book in the name of consistency? And to what degree do we want to allow individual member states to set up individual rules that might help them establish themselves as a particular locus for a particular type of activity? Those debates are very much ongoing right now and will continue well beyond Brexit, perhaps with more intensity.
That's quite interesting, but surely when it came to ever closer union and integration, Britain's membership of the EU kind of acted as a handbrake historically. Is that right?
Broadly speaking, yes. And certainly having Britain not joining the euro and not ever joining the euro gave a lot of cover for the other member states that haven't joined the euro and might not be interested in that. With Britain leaving and with Bulgaria having applied to join the euro formally, for example, you've got fewer and fewer states that are standing outside the common currency. And they're going to really have to rethink how much they want to work together, how much they're willing to stand alone, and what their role is going to be now that they don't have a nexus like that for anchoring debate.
That's interesting. Before we wrap this up, I have one more thought I would just like to put to you. It seems that one of the characteristics of populism is that voters have become agnostic about the benefits of having a thriving financial services industry within their country. Do you think politicians are going to bother pandering to, well, maybe not pandering, but do you think politicians are going to bother protecting these big centres for much longer, especially if it hurts their ability to act as kind of sovereign players on the world stage, which seems to be how they're perceived in Britain?
Protecting is such an interesting verb. Britain has a strong interest in continuing to be a world leader in financial services, and it probably will be. Some of the estimates I've seen are that London might shrink by 10% or a little more because of the shifts related to Brexit. And that's a lot, but that's not enough to completely undercut the city as a financial services locus. So from Britain's perspective, this is a great thing. This is a thing that it exports. This is a thing that it's known for. And one would think that they will continue to want to have those jobs and that money and that interest. In a sense, the financial services economic activity is different from the foreign investment that's been driving some of the more disturbing trends like housing prices in London and things like that. The people who are actually living and working in London are a little bit different than the people who are just parking their money in London because it's a good place to have assets. On the European side, the focus has been on limiting risk. We've seen a lot of regulation and activity to require banks to set aside more capital, to plan more strategically for what might happen if they were to fail in the future. We've seen common European supervision set up within the euro area. We've seen everybody being required to put together these resolution plans in a common resolution area within the euro area. Again, is this single resolution mechanism. So there's been a lot of focus on protecting society from crisis in the financial sector. I think that's where the focus is probably going to be. Just to circle back to where we started, the great thing about Brexit so far has been that there hasn't been a crisis. But also the limiting thing about Brexit is that there's no crisis. And in the absence of crisis, it's hard to get the urgency to make really drastic changes to much of anything.
That's interesting. And I mean, I was just thinking about that because banking is perceived as being quite an elite kind of profession and industry, isn't it? So I was wondering if, you know, how do you kind of tell the average person that they benefit from having that sector on their doorstep if they feel divorced from it?
When people think of banking as elite, they really mean big banking and investment banking. And that's the sort of thing that, if it's working well, doesn't really affect ordinary people. If the big banks and the big financial companies are working as they should, they're operating at a level, at a wholesale level. They're making sure that there's always enough money in the economy, that people who need it can borrow it, can find it, that it can get from one place to another and not get caught somewhere. So this isn't something that people ought to have to spend a lot of time thinking about. They ought to be able to delegate that to their regulators. In terms of banking per se, certainly within Europe and within the euro area, there are lots and lots of small banks. Those banks are going to continue operating and continue dealing with the risks and new climate that we have after the crisis. And I think that's what people are going to see in terms of their actual doorsteps.
Well, and one could also argue that some of the excessive salaries involved probably make inequality a lot worse than it has to be. But that may be another topic for another podcast. Thank you very much for joining us, Rebecca. It's always nice to have you here. Which financial centre are you driving off to tonight?
I'm headed off to Luxembourg. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, you did ask me about to ask you about any trips. Is Luxembourg worth visiting?
It is more fun than you would think.
More fun than you would think.
It's got these castles. And if you have the time to park and walk around the ramparts and explore the castles in the medieval city, I find it quite fabulous from an architectural point of view and a way of looking beyond just the big banks and the European institutions that certainly people in Brussels think of when they think about Luxembourg.
Great. You've been listening to Sound of Economics. This podcast was not brought to you by the Luxembourg Tourism Board, and we hope you subscribe and listen again in the future. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to The Sound of Economics. This podcast was presented by me, Nicholas Barrett, and edited by Tiago Almeida, and brought to you by the Bruegel think tank in Brussels. To read our papers and blogs, you can visit bruegel.org, and if you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on Spotify and iTunes, where you can also leave us a review and let other people know that we exist. And you can stay up to date with everything we do by following us on Twitter, @bruegel_org. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.